my clicker up here. I need that. All right. If you were here last week, we are starting to look at the accuracy of the Bible and how that we can rely on it and be sure about it. But we looked at several quote, well, just one quote, really, from a fellow from Newsweek. And I'm not going to look at all of them again, but just the last part of it. You might remember that this kind of ties into what we're dealing with. And so he talks about the idea no television preacher has ever read the Bible, neither has any evangelical politician, neither has the Pope, neither have I, neither have you. And so you know what he's getting at there, of course, is the idea that we really don't have the Bible. And so if you weren't here last week, there was four or five screens worth of quotes from this fella, and it was pretty negative. But along the way, he seemed to try to speak of the Bible as if he kind of believed it, that there was a God anyway, that sort of thing. But just kind of giving lip service to the Bible. I think he called it a great book in one point of his quotes. But he really, when it's all said and done, doesn't believe that we really have the Word of God today. In fact, he talks about the distance between the idea of 400 years passed between the writing of the first Christian manuscripts and the compilation into the New Testament. Again, we've already kind of dealt with that, haven't we? About when the canon came along and all of that. And so it probably was close to 400 years. But you remember, we emphasized the fact that the books, the letters that were written were inspired the moment they were inspired, not when they were put into the canon and made a canon. The important thing is that they're inspired. That's why they're in the canon, not the other way around. And so just the language that he uses, he comes across as a very smart fella, but really doesn't know what he's talking about, especially when he talks of the idea of receiving a translation from a translation of that's just wrong. That's not the case at all. We haven't received a translation of a translation of a translation, unless you're Catholic. I shouldn't say that. So, but the Catholics basically, we'll get into this a little bit later, but basically they have received a translation of a translation. But they haven't received a translation of a translation of a translation. That's just an exaggeration to make it look bad. And that's not the case at all. And you might remember that he started off by saying, all we have is a bad translation. Like, why did it have to be a bad translation? He's just anti-Bible. And he, Fred Etheridge went, he went home. I love Fred. He went home and looked up this fella. and you kind of get the idea of, you know, he has an agenda, really. And he says in this little piece, did this come from Newsweek too? I don't know if it did come from Newsweek. But anyway, said gay marriage opponents must argue that being gay is a choice against all evidence, science, and logic, because otherwise they have to confront this. Now listen to this. Either God is a monster, condemning people to eternal torment for being what he made them, or the Bible, with its endless contradictions, its magicians turning sticks into snakes, its celebration of slavery and genocide was not handed down by a deity. And so when you start listening to some of the things that that same fellow writes, you see he's anti-Bible is what he is. And he doesn't really believe that the Bible was handed down by God and that it shouldn't be taken literally. Now, here's the thing. And the reason I even put all this up on the screen in the first place is because that attitude is growing in our society today. Like, it's much worse than it was even 50 years ago. That now it's not just fellows like him and atheists and agnostics who have trouble believing the Bible. It now a lot of these people will claim, like he kind of did. I don't know where he stands. He might claim to be some kind of religion or so. I don't know, but But a lot of people who are religiously inclined and who say, I believe in God, are coming to this position that you're foolish if you take the Bible literally. Like, that's just nonsense. You don't have to do that, and you shouldn't do that. And that tribe, that group of people who think like that, is growing. And so that's kind of the situation that we're in. So, I mean, this is even this study, it doesn't seem like it, and it's not primarily meant to be evangelistic, but there's an evangelistic worth to it in that when you all go out and deal with people, and you have Bible studies, even with people you work with and have friends with, you better know that a lot of sometimes their attitude is going to be, when you try to convince them about baptism, whatever, their attitude is going to be, you mean you take that literally? You have to take that. They don't take it literally. They don't think you have to take the Bible literally. Because what we really have at the end of the day isn't something we can even be sure was originally written in the first place. Because after all, it's a translation of a translation of a translation of a translation. And that's the growing attitude. And you're going to have to, maybe, you know, obviously not in the detail that we're going to in this study, but you're going to have to be able to answer that and tell people why it is that you believe that the Bible is inspired. Like some of the things that we talked about in the pre-scientific evidence, in the archaeology, and the prophecies, and all those things. You're going to have to be able to call some of that to mind and say, no, this is what God wrote. This is the Word of God. It was handed down by deity. And be able to explain that process just a little bit. Well, one of the great witnesses, of course, have to do with the manuscripts that we have. And it's not the only witness. We'll get into later. It's just amazing that we have so much evidence. That I think I've already told, there are over 5,000, nearly 6,000 manuscripts that the textual critic has access to when he's trying to reconstruct what was originally written. And when you think about that volume of manuscripts, you may not even realize, but when you compare it to classical writings and the manuscripts that they have and other ancient writings that scholars and others have absolute confidence in. When you compare the number of manuscripts they have for the things they believe in and what the Bible has, I mean, it's just amazing how much evidence we have. And the manuscripts aren't even the only source we can turn to. There are also all of these ancient versions that we talked about. Like those versions, remember, they came from some kind of text. And so you can look at them and compare them just like you can the manuscripts and reconstruct what was originally written. And then on top of that, we have all of the quotes from the early theologians of the first, second, third century, fourth century. And I think I made mention to you before, it's absolutely amazing. We can just take those quotes alone. If we didn't have anything else but the quotes of those early preachers and theologians and scholars, just take their quotes alone, we could piece together the Bible. The New Testament, at least. And that's amazing. But the primary witness are the manuscripts that we have. Now, what is a manuscript? A manuscript, technically a manuscript is anything written by hand. But when you start talking about the Bible and New Testament documents, it's generally agreed that a manuscript is a document that was written by hand in the original language. So a New Testament manuscript is a Greek manuscript, and it is written by hand. And again, we just have volumes and volumes of them. And so we're going to be looking at some of these manuscripts, and usually they're grouped, they were often, and this isn't something that is always true, certainly. But generally speaking, we know already from our studies that after the letters were written, they generally were circulated individually. But pretty soon they began to be collected and gathered together, so they were circulated as a group. And those manuscripts, though, then were in codex form rather than on a scroll. You know, like all in the Old Testament, they were on scrolls and things. But they began to be in codices, so because it was more practical. And everybody started. By the first century A.D., the classical literature, everything were written in that codex form. And then you can write on both sides of the pages, what they call leaves. You can write on both sides. And you could obviously just be more practical. Like, can you imagine, again, when they began to collect them, instead of just having one letter, like the book of Romans, that'd be one thing. But when they started to have the four Gospels, you know, to have it in one codex instead of, you know, you imagine walking around with four scrolls instead. You know, so it was more practical. So that's what they began to discover. And usually, and again, not always, but a lot of times they were in this kind of format. You'd find a codex with the four Gospels in them. And so there's many of those with just the Gospels, and it may have all four, or it may have two of them, and whatever. But they would come like that, and then often there would be Acts and the general epistles. But sometimes you'd find them with the Gospels and Acts. Often you'd have just the Paul's epistles. And the ones usually that he wrote to local churches as opposed to individuals. And then there are many of just Revelation kind of be by itself. And again, nothing written in stone. There's so many of those nearly 6,000 manuscripts. You know, they'd come in a lot of different forms. But they began to discover groupings like that. Now, as we think about these manuscripts, then there's two major kinds. First of all, the uncials, and these were basically you knew them. I mean, these manuscripts, you'd know what kind they were just by looking at them, because the uncials would have rounded characters in capital letters, and there would be no space between the letters, or between the words rather. So it would all run together. And here is a example of a real manuscript. I don't know where that's taken from, but that's what it would look like. I mean, whether it was a religious document or of some other sort, an uncial would look just like that. Only if that was in English, you would really be able to tell. I probably should have just put some words up there in English. Maybe I did that before. But if I put a portion of Romans up there in the uncial format, you'd really be able to tell. Because you'd have, like, if the word from was at the end of the line, it would end on with F, and then R-O-M would be on the next line. And that's just the way they did it. They weren't nice and neat like we are, you know, and hyphenated things. It wasn't neat like that. So you can imagine in that kind of writing how the scribe might make some mistakes in trying to copy that. But that's what an uncial looked like. And now, the uncials came in two kinds. They're actually two kind, but there was a distinction between the two. The first were written on vellum or parchment. And the vellum would be the nice lamb calfskin. And then and the parchment would just be sheep or goat skin. But those uncials, if you could see on the screen, they were copied between the 4th and the 9th century. And we have in our midst about 300 of them that you can go to various places. And there's a lot of people who travel around the world to some of the museums and libraries where these things are located just to look at them and take pictures of them and just investigate them. But there's 300 of them. And so that was one kind. And then there's the papyrus uncials, and we have just about 95 of those. And again, they're distinguished in those groups, but they're both uncials. They both look like what you see on the screen, but there's a clear distinction between the two. And even in the discovery of them, the papyrus, they weren't discovered mostly until the 20th century or so. And so they were discovered late, but they were copied very early from the 2nd and 3rd century is when they were copied. So that is huge when you think about the date of that. Then you have what's called the cursive. Sometimes they're called minuscules because they were real small font and it was like cursive-like characters. And that's an example of what the cursive would look like. Now, when we talk about all the manuscripts that we have, probably about 5,000 of them are in cursives. So the large majority of them are in cursives. And look at the late date of those, 9th to the 15th century. So those are less valuable than the 395 or whatever that, round numbers really. But of the unsolds are way more valuable. We may talk about that a little bit more later. I'm not quite sure we will, but we may. When they were copied does make a difference. And it just depends on your school of thought. Like there's some people, like the King James and the New King James, they're based on what they call the majority text. And what they do basically is they believe that numbers always win. Like it's like taking a vote and whoever has the most votes wins, which isn't an unreasonable approach. Like, you have a 1,000 manuscripts and they all say the same thing. You can pretty much think, okay, that's what the original said. So that's the majority text kind of approach to it. And it sounds good and it is good, except it's not always the right way to go. Like sometimes you can have a few manuscripts that were written 600 years or copied 600 or 700 years earlier. And because of when it was copied and sometimes even the location of it, that those few become more valuable than the majority. And generally speaking, that's the case with the unsolds and the cursive. There's way more cursives than there are unsolds, but the unsolds are by far most scholars would tell you immediately, except for the diehard King James only people. But most will tell you immediately that the weight is with the early copies. But now most scholars today take the approach, they look at all the factors involved, which is the best approach. But there's some who would have an agenda again and want you to, either they love the King James or others hate the King James, and that colors their attitude towards all these things. But those are the manuscripts, the three, basically, again, two groups, but basically three, two major kinds, the also unsolds and the cursives, but the unsolds are distinguished by those that they actually call unsolds, and then the papyrus. And so we're going to take a look then at those three categories of manuscripts. And so we begin with the papyri. And the first group is what they call the Oxyrhynchus papyri. And that is the kind of an interesting story there. There was a city in 79 AD that existed on the slope of a volcano. And the volcano erupted and destroyed the city. And so nothing. I mean, that was that for a long time. But then that was way back in 79 AD. But then in the 1700s, they started to excavate that area. Herculaneum was the town that it was. But they started to excavate it in the 1700s, and they uncovered several things. This is a villa that they uncovered, and it's really fascinating when you look at it. If you had an up close shot at this, I don't know how well you can see this, but you can kind of. I keep forgetting I have a thing on here, but I don't know how to do it. Uh-oh. That it? There it is. All right. You can kind of see these trees up on the hill here. Like all this is dug out. And if you really look back here, there's a city there. But this is an ancient city that they dug out. it's kind of neat. Can you see in this view, maybe even a little better, can. See that city behind it? All that down there? That's Herculaneum. That's not Herculaneum. It's just a villa in Herculaneum. That the whole city was destroyed by the volcano. But the reason that's interesting there, because they went and they excavated it and they found thousands of papyri there. And that became known as the Villa of Papyri. And so what that did, you know how man is, people are fascinated with ancient things, you know, regardless of what it is, really. And people, you know, something that's a couple of thousand years old, you know, that automatically interest. And so when they discovered that, that started particularly in the 1800s, that started men going on all of these searches and doing excavations, trying to find ancient papyri and all different kinds. And in 1895, a fellow by the name of Bernard Greenfell was sent to Egypt with some other people to excavate a place in Egypt. Egypt was a place where a lot of people went to try to find this papyri because of the climate there. It's dry and all the, you know, things would be buried under the sand and the papyri would be well preserved in that situation. So everybody was going to Egypt to try to find a new papyri. So they sent this Greenfell to a place called El Fayum, and he discovered a bunch of very successful. It was kind of like a trial to see if he could find anything, and he found a lot. So he got in contact with one of his best friends back home, Arthur Hunt, and told him to come and help him, and they worked together, and that started a long relationship, and Greenfell and Hunt are well known as individuals who've done a lot of work in publishing different papyri with regard to the scriptures and things. But they went back the next year to Egypt to, you know, do some more excavating. And for whatever reason, these are the two fellows right there. Again, they're kind of famous for this in this realm of academia. They're famous for all the things they have published and discovered. And they decided to go south. And you see way down there at the bottom is Oxyrhynchus. And they that's about 70 miles away from Cairo. And I get my red dot here again. This is where the El Fayum was, right in that area around this, looks like a body of water there. And they decided to go down here because that was known. That place was known to be a stronghold for Christians in the third and fourth centuries. A lot of Christians lived there. And they figure, wonder if they left some writings behind. So they went and excavated that place. And the first couple of weeks or so, they just didn't have any luck, didn't find anything at all. And then they went to a part of the town that was, for all practical purposes, the dump, where they would throw away their trash. And immediately, they started to find all kinds of papyri. Most of it's not biblical at all. There'd be tax records, personal letters, bills of sales, all kind of things that they discovered on papyrus. But as they were doing that and excavating the place, Hunt came across a little fragment of papyrus, and it had the Greek word karphis on it. And karphis is the Greek word for moat. Now, Steve, if I said moat, what would you think of? You think of a castle. What would you think? A moat in your eye. That's exactly right. A moat or speck. but a moat. When you think of course, you know, I'm thinking King James now, and so was Hunt, I guess, because he saw that word, and immediately Matthew 7 came to his mind, and he thought, moat. You don't see that word all that often, but I know I've seen it in the Bible. This might be a fragment of Scripture. So that's what it was. It was Matthew chapter 7, verse 5. And so they kept on digging, And they found more fragments. And in the end, they ended up finding these various fragments and books. And this is how they just identified. P for papyrus, obviously. And then P1 is Matthew chapter 1. That's a huge find. And again, I don't know if I mentioned it before, but when we talk about all of 5,000, almost 6,000 manuscripts, we are mostly talking about fragments. And so when you would find a whole chapter or a whole book, that'd be a great discovery. You know, and it's kind of adventurous when you stop thinking about people going on these searches because they want to find things. Can you imagine when you do discover something? And these are the things that they discovered. P5 was John 1 and John 16. P13, Hebrews 2 through 5 and 10 through 12. And you can just go down the list and that's what they, that's not all they found there. I think that there was 27 in total that they found and eventually found more. I think there's today you can get online and Google, and I think the Oxyrhynchus papyri are in 15 volumes, I think, is what it is. So, you know, great discovery. They found so much papyri, they brought back 280 boxes worth of material. But now just a small part of it was biblical, but that's a part. Those are some of the manuscripts that now textual critics can look at and start to compare. But the big thing about that is these things date back to the 2nd and 3rd century. Like that is just that is right close to when the original letters were written, and that's huge. Then you have the Chester Beatty papyri, and they're named, of course, after they're named that because the guy who bought them was Chester Beatty, and he bought them from a dealer in Egypt. And because of that, you don't know, like you don't really have a story of where they found them or anything, because you buy them off a dealer, and that no telling where the dealer got them originally from. So it's kind of hard to tell. But this Chester Beatty, when he was just a child, he got interested in collecting things. And he was an American who lived in, ultimately lived in London. But he became a famous businessman in his day, was very rich, made his money in the mining business. But he got into collecting and he's going to auctions and collecting things. In fact, the story is told that when he was 10 years old, he went to an auction with his father, and all he had was 10 cents. And so whatever it was that they were trying to sell, he raised his hand and he had 10 cents. And all the other men there that were engaged in it were, just tickled by the fact that he would offer 10 cents, that none of them would bid. And so he won 10 cents. How do you think that the auctioneer felt about that? He was quite upset. but for the rest of his life, he was into collecting things. I mean, everything from stamps to Chinese snuff bottles, just everything. He would collect them. And he would travel around the world. Now, remember, he became pretty wealthy, and he would travel to China, Japan, and Egypt, Cairo many times. And he got interested in all his collecting and things. He got interested in ancient papyri. And so he purchased from this Egyptian dealer this what is now called the Chester Beatty papyri. And what is in that is P 45, and that contained the Gospels in Acts. And then he bought another one that had all of Paul's epistles, and then one that had the Book of Revelation in it. And so that's called the Chester Beatty papyri. And again, the worth of those things is that these were a little bit earlier, just a little bit, but just earlier than the Oxyrhynchus papyri. So that makes them very valuable in the minds of most. And guess where they're located? In the Chester Beatty Library. And you go there, and you can, I know this picture's kind of hard to see, but you can see some of the things that are there, some of the manuscripts that are there in that library. And so that's in Dublin. Some people who travel to Dublin just take a picture of that. I remember a preacher calling me up when I was in Bloomington and wanted to go to, you know, there's some manuscripts in Chicago. And a couple of us are going to Chicago to see it. I really wasn't much into it, so I said, no, I don't really want to go. So anyway, maybe it was the company I didn't really want to keep. But that's the Chester Beatty papyri. Then there's the Bodmer papyri, and on this one there's a large portion of John. The thing that's impressive about these is the length of them. They're pretty early, but the length of them. A large portion of John, 1st, 2nd Peter, and Jude. Those are complete books. Of 1st, 2nd Peter and Jude, the complete books. Now, what a find that was. And a large portion of Luke and John, it's the oldest copy, complete copy of Luke. The book of Luke is complete there in that collection. And that's the oldest copy of Luke on earth, the oldest that we have. And so, pretty important. Now, very quickly, before the bell rings, there's one more. And there's a lot more. These are the significant ones. We could look at several more of them. But the John Riley's fragment is fascinating, and only because there's a picture of it. It contains on one side John 18:31 through 33. Now, if you flip that over, and a lot of times you'll see this. You see it on both sides. On the other side of that is John 18:37 and 38. So it's a tiny fragment. It's about 3.5 inches long and 2.5 inches wide, and just a little fragment. It was discovered at I'm trying to think of the fellow's name who I talked about earlier, Greenfell. He was acquiring a bunch of manuscripts for a museum, and he was categorizing them for the Rylands Museum or library, and he was just cataloging them, and I don't know what happened, but he must have died or something, and someone took over the work, and a guy by the name of Roberts took over the work, and as he was cataloging all of these papyri, he came across this, just found this little tiny fragment on it. But they started dating it. And it dated all the way back to the first half of the second century, about 125 CE. That's 125. Now you think about that. It's the oldest, right there, that's the oldest manuscript in existence that we have. Like, that's first cousins with John. I mean, 125. That is. You don't realize how huge that. Now again, it's just a tiny little thing. But a lot of people used to think, oh, the Book of John wasn't written where everybody thought it was. It was written sometime in the second century. Well, that blew that right out of the water, because here's a copy of the original autograph. That would probably be one of the first copies of John ever made. And it was copied in 125. It's just amazing. And so most people, the scholars just wish that somehow they could find the rest of that. but it's just a little tiny fragment. But they have dated it all the way back to 125. So the second bell's going to ring there. We'll take a look. That's the papyri. And those are the most important pieces of evidence and the documents that basically we have, because they're the earliest ones that we have. The next ones are the unshells, And there's, as you saw on the screen, there's about 300 of them, but there's three, sometimes people say four, great ones. And they're manuscripts that basically are the only manuscripts we have that are complete, that have both the Old and the New Testament together and are almost, not completely, but almost complete. And they date back to the 4th century. And so they're very, very valuable. And we'll tell the story of those on next week. I'll quit just a second early. I'm sure that bell is about to ring. So I told you.